What would it cost society and business to reduce climate change by cutting greenhouse gas emissions? Will it harm our economy if we just go on with business as usual? How much? These questions are addressed in this lecture by Lord Adair Turner in Britain. Given February 7, 2007, Turner explains the logic of the Stern Report, just issued by Sir Nicholas Stern on behalf of the UK government. The Stern Report predicts it would cost about 1% of the world's production to modify our energy, forestry, and agricultural systems toward a low-carbon state. Just leaving things as they are, with ever-rising greenhouse gases, would strip 5 to 20% from our wealth, Stern says. Adair Turner is a businessman and advisor to the Blair government. He has been Director General of the Confederation of British Industry, a lobby group, and he organized the Sustainable Development Commission. This speech, The Economics of Climate Change, was presented at Savoy Place in London. The first half of the one-hour speech investigates the prospects and costs of mitigating emissions of greenhouse gases. It contains a game plan that can be understood by anyone. The second part is more difficult, analyzing the economic techniques used by Stern to estimate the cost of climate-induced damage. Turner addresses three criticisms of Stern's calculations from other economists. It helps to understand the term discount rate ahead of time, so the last part of the speech will be clearer to those with a background in either business or economics. Still, it is important to join the struggle to understand how difficult it is to measure such imponderables as the economic value of losing tens of thousands of species, or dislocation of millions of people, horrors difficult to measure out in pounds, euros, or dollars. A video of the speech has been available online, and both parts are available for free download from the climate menu of www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. Here is the speech by Jonathan Adair Turner. This is part two of two.
But while as a percentage of GDP these costs are small, in absolute terms they are large. 1% of world GDP is about $500 billion. So obviously it wouldn't make sense to accept these manageable costs unless the adverse consequences of climate change were larger. The problem of climate change economics is that when we turn from mitigation costs to the costs of adverse consequences, agreement collapses and complexity explodes. Stern may say that the adverse consequences could be equivalent to 20% of GDP lost now and forever, but Richard Toll can produce figures as low as 0.5% to 2%. And Stern himself presents not a single estimate, but a very wide range. He says that the best judgment lies somewhere between 5 and 20%, but actually 1% is possible, and so too is 35%. So why this huge range? And what, if anything, can economics tell us if it can't pin down the facts more precisely than a range of 1 to 35%? Well, the problem is that calculating and aggregating the costs of adverse consequences involves at least four layers of complexity. The first is that we need to consider not only direct market economy impacts, but also non-market impacts. Working out the economic value of possible changes in agricultural yields or the cost of sea defences or losses from extreme weather events is computationally complex and involves a set of uncertain estimates, but at least these effects are ones which are directly measurable in GDP terms. They're the sort of effects which we know well how to turn into pounds billion. But climate change will also create increased deaths from heat waves, offset also by fewer deaths from cold snaps. It will encourage the spread of tropical diseases, and it will flood some coastal areas and lead to movement of people. And while economics has developed techniques for estimating the value placed on a human life or on human health, those estimates are highly imperfect and inherently judgmental. And climate change might produce what economists call socially contingent effects, creeping desertification producing movement of people, which in turn produces political instability, which in turn undermines economic progress and quality of life. But try putting a figure on that danger. And climate change can impose costs which are entirely subjective, but which are also part of the calculus of human welfare. Personally, I value the diversity of nature as an end in itself. If climate change leads to habitat loss, which leads to the disappearance of major species, I would regret that. And the fact that people give large amounts of money to environmental charities suggests that many other people share that preference. It is what economists call a revealed preference. So the preservation of the environment and of species as an end in itself should be given some value in the calculation. But how much? So there is a major problem in aggregating direct economic effects, which influence measured GDP and material consumption, with non-market effects on health, on social stability, or on the environment itself. But even if you do that, for each country considered alone, there is a second and very major aggregation problem. How to add together the welfare of different people, rich and poor? Because the way economists typically place a dollar equivalent value on human health effects is to ask how much income people would logically and do actually sacrifice to preserve life and death. And the answer to that question is, of course, much bigger in richer countries because they've got more income available to sacrifice. But that technique, which is a useful technique within a country to assess the cost effectiveness of alternative policies, is surely unethical if it implies that a human life in Niger, say, should count for less in climate change policy than a human life in America. So we need to adjust our technique to weigh human welfare equally, but it turns out that that's a pretty complex thing to do. Two further complexities also have to be faced. The first is that the harm caused by climate change is likely to be strongly non-linear, as economists say, that 4 degrees change is likely to produce much more harm than 2 degrees centigrade change. But it's unclear how much more harmful and whether you can capture that non-linearity in any model form of the form y equals x squared or y equals x cubed or y equals e to the x, or whether what we face is some sort of unique non-regular shape with damage increasing dramatically once some threshold is reached. And with it also unclear whether any given concentration level of gases will take us beyond whatever those threshold temperatures, those tipping point temperature levels are. Since the science too provides us not with certainties, 550 parts per million will equal a rise of 3 degrees centigrade, but instead with probability distributions, such as it might be 3 degrees centigrade, but there's a 10% chance that it could be 5 degrees centigrade. We therefore need to build our aggregate calculations on probability distributions of possible results and to place a subjective value on uncertainty. How much should we pay for excluding the 10% possibility of severely adverse effects or the 1% possibility of utter catastrophe, even if the most likely result is only modestly averse? This cumulative complexity explains why we end up with 1 to 35%. And it creates a big challenge for climate change economics, that if we stick to the clearly measurable adverse consequences, avoiding the conceptual complexities, we systematically underestimate the consequences for human welfare. And one key reason why Stern's estimates are higher than others is simply that he has attempted, however imperfectly, to deal with all the complexities, or at least nearly all, since even Stern's figures made no allowance for those socially contingent effects. They just decided that that was a step too far in computational complexity. And this cumulative complexity also carries implications for the role which aggregate estimates of damage should play in the debate. They are only useful as indicators of orders of magnitude and as double checks to supplement a more straightforward approach, which is to look at the different adverse consequences separately and descriptively. What likely impacts on agricultural yield? What possible consequences for human health? What impact on potentially displaced communities? What loss of biodiversity? And what impact separately on rich and poor? To look at that descriptively and to reach a judgment essentially subjective on how much you would be willing to pay to at least mitigate those adverse effects. there is no black box calculator which can free us from the responsibility to make those judgments and those ethical judgments. But insofar as the aggregate figures tell us anything, we should take from them four messages. First, that there is a huge range of uncertainty, but that uncertainty is an argument in favour of action, in favour of taking out an insurance policy, not an action against. Second, that almost all the models indicate much higher costs to human welfare in poorer developing countries than in rich developed ones, simply because the poorer countries are concentrated in already warmer parts of the world and are vulnerable precisely because they are poor. Third, that the models suggest that adverse consequences will probably increase rapidly as we go beyond thresholds of something like 3 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, which is something like 2 degrees centigrade above present levels. Fourth, that inevitably judgmental but still reasonable assumptions can produce estimates of total damage far higher than our much more certain estimates of the cost of mitigation. These four conclusions establish a strong case for action, and in particular for action which seeks to limit the chances that future temperature rises will go above some modest threshold. But that is not the conclusion we'll reach even if you attempt to capture all consequences for human welfare, if when you come to comparing sacrifices today with benefits in the future, you use a high discount rate. The choice of discount rate alone indeed explains over half of the difference between Nordhaus's estimate of an optimal 25% emissions cut in 2100 and Stern's estimate of a 90% cut. With a 4% discount rate, £1,000 in 150 years' time is worth £3.66 today. The future doesn't matter very much. With a 2% discount rate, it's worth £59. With a 4% discount rate and 2% growth, you wouldn't even sacrifice 1% of GDP to save 15% of GDP, or the human welfare equivalent of GDP, in 150 years' time. The loss in 150 years' time would need to be 16.1% to make that sacrifice sensible. With a 2% discount rate and 2% growth, saving only 1% of GDP in 150 years' time would be worth sacrificing 1% today. When the growth rate and the discount rate are the same, 1% of GDP at any point in time is, as it were, worth the same. But the discipline of economics actually provides no definitive resolution of what the discount rate should be, but instead two quite different approaches and many possible answers. Professor Nordhaus's approach is often called the descriptive approach. You derive your estimate of the discount rate from observing the rates of return actually achieved on productive investments across the whole economy, a figure which economists tend to estimate at about being about 4 or 5% real. And the argument for this approach is twofold. First, that if you are considering sacrificing consumption today to achieve reduced emissions for the benefit of the future, you should consider also the alternative of taking the foregone consumption, investing it in productive assets, and increasing future GDP in a way which will compensate for future climate change effects. Second, that the actual rate of return in the marketplace tells us about people's preferences between consumption now and in the future, and it's not the job of economists to tell people how they should make that trade-off, but simply to explore the consequences of their revealed preferences. By contrast, Stern's approach, and also Professor Dasgupta's, entails deriving discount rates from a priori logic and from ethics. In this approach, the discount rate is given by the formula R equals eta times the growth rate plus delta, where these terms have the following meaning. Eta is a factor known as the elasticity of the marginal utility of consumption. It determines how the value we place on an extra unit of consumption or welfare should vary with the level of consumption or welfare already achieved. All economists pretty much believe that there is a declining marginal utility of consumption, that an extra pound is worth less to to a rich person than to a poor person. And that makes intuitive sense. The key question is, how much more is it worth to a poor person than to a rich person? The factor eta is a measure of how much more. It tells you how curved that line is relating welfare to consumption, how rapidly the marginal benefit of extra income declines as income itself rises, whether between people in the same generation or between people in this generation and next. Because you can plot on that path either people in the same generation or different generations. Now, Stern assumes a base case value of 1, which is a value with the implication that while a pound in 2100 is worth less than a pound today, provided the economy has grown, 1% of GDP in 2100 is worth exactly the same as 1% of GDP today. That is the consequence of that assumption that he's made. Dasgupta agrees with this broad conceptual approach, but believes that the specific eta that Stern uses as his base case places too much value on the marginal prosperity of richer people, because remember, future people are richer as well, that the curve should curve more, should flatten out more. G is the growth rate in GDP, which should be measured after adjusting for the adverse effects of climate change, so that if those adverse effects were big enough to actually pull total human welfare downwards, the discount rate should actually logically be a negative and not a positive. Delta, meanwhile, measures how much more we should value consumption today rather than consumption in the future, not because future people are likely to be richer than us, but simply because we who are making the decision care more about ourselves than about people in the future. And Stern argues that it is ethically unacceptable to set this at other than a very low level. He uses a 0.1% base case. In total, with an illustrative growth rate of 1.9%, that produces a discount rate of 1.91%, well below Nordhaus's 4%. And from that difference flows over half the difference between Nordhaus's 25% cut in 2100 and Stern's 90%. How to decide between these different approaches? I believe, along with Nick Stern, that there are compelling reasons for following the descriptive approach. But I do believe that Dasgupta's argument for different parameters, a slightly higher eta, has some power. But Stern's sensitivities, which he provided in the report, illustrate that changing the parameters does not change the overall conclusion. First, the descriptive approach. Its first argument was that if the rate of return on investment is 4% today, and if you want to help offset climate change consequences in 2100 by sacrificing some consumption today, you have the option of sort of investing in a fund for future climate change offsets, investing foregone consumption in productive assets, rather than accepting lower GDP to achieve emission reductions. But this argument is surely flawed on two grounds. First, the impossibility of being certain that the proceeds of this hypothetical fund would actually be used to compensate future climate change losers. Second, the fact that we don't know what the rate of return will be beyond the near-term future, and that, as Stern argues, it is itself a function of future growth after allowing for climate change effects. Defenders of the descriptive approach therefore have to move on, and in debate typically do move on, to their second line of argument. Accepting that the discount rate should be determined by a formula so that it might change through time, with input parameters eta and delta, but arguing that the value of eta and delta should be set so as to be compatible with observed rates of return, since those observed rates tell us about actual revealed preferences. So that if the observed rate of return is about 4% and the growth rate is about 2%, an eta of 2 and a delta of 1% would be possible, but Stern's proposed values would not. People's revealed preferences, thus they say, suggest that people care less about the future than Stern suggests they should. But the arguments against this approach are also, I believe, totally compelling. Individuals may, within their own lifetime, be either rationally or irrationally impatient. They may prefer consumption today simply because they might die early and never enjoy consumption in the future, or because they myopically do not think about the future. And their own savings decisions, and therefore rates of return within the economy, will reflect this impatience. But neither their rational nor irrational impatience is an ethically acceptable basis on which to determine the discount rate between present and future generations. The more we care about the welfare of future generations, the more we should take climate change actions today. There is nothing in sound economics which frees us from that ethical choice. Even accepting that, however, I think it is possible to sympathise with Dasgupta's argument for a somewhat higher ITA than Stern's base case. For as Dasgupta stresses, a good test of a sensible parameter value is that it produces results which feel intuitively right. With an ITA of 1, you can construct some propositions which don't necessarily feel right, even to someone who believes we should take action to mitigate climate change. Thus, for instance, suppose there were no climate change problem, and there was no problem of countries being rich and poor, and that in such a world, the government proposed a plan to cut current consumption by 1% today in order to achieve a 1.11% increase in GDP in 2100, which would make slightly richer still the people of 2100, who in any case are likely to be far richer than we are today. Stern's ITA of 1 would say do it, because 1% of GDP tomorrow is worth as much as 1% today, so 1.11 in 2100 is worth more than 1% today. But it's not a clearly compelling proposition. Set the ITA higher, perhaps at the 1.5 which Dasgupta suggests, and you wouldn't make this trade-off because you would attach less value to future increments in the prosperity of already richer future people. And yet, Stern's conclusion that we should act now to offset climate change damage later does feel ethically compelling, even while that simple example I just used does not, or at least not to me. And there are good reasons why that is the case. Because what is proposed in climate change action is not actually a sacrifice of average consumption today to achieve increased average material consumption in 2100, but instead a much more complicated trade-off, which makes the whole concept of one discount rate a huge simplification. And I think this is important to realise, that we are in an area of policy where a little economics, or even an intermediate level of economics, is quite a dangerous thing. There are people who think that they are bringing sound economics because they've discovered what a discount rate is, but in this arena, we actually need discount rates. For we are back with the problems encountered earlier. How to aggregate market and non-market effects, and how to aggregate welfare effects across countries of widely different prosperity. If, for instance, on the top half, we believe that the future is one of growing material consumption, you'll have more washing machines and televisions and cars if you want, but declining environmental quality, and if we value those separately and refuse to add them together, then the discount rate, whatever the ITA, should be positive for consumption because it is worth less at the margin as it grows, but negative for environmental quality because it's getting more precious as it declines. And we can only aggregate these together and use one discount rate if we are very confident about the relative weight we attach to those two quite divergent trends. And the discount rate should also, in principle, vary according to who loses and who gains. If it really was the case that we were talking about an average British citizen sacrificing consumption today for the benefit of a richer average Briton in 100 years' time, the discount rate should clearly be positive and perhaps higher than Stern's ITA of 1.0 implies. But if an average Briton sacrifices consumption today to benefit a poorer African in 2100, the discount rate should be much lower than in the first case. And if even in 2100 the poorer African will still be poorer than the average Briton today, it should actually be negative. Ideally, we shouldn't be applying one across-the-board discount rate, but discount rates which reflect specifically who sacrifices and who gains. But that implies adding yet more complexity to already horribly complex models. Picking a slightly lower ITA than might normally be appropriate is one way of offsetting the bias introduced by the simplification of one discount rate, which practicality requires. So perhaps truth, or at least best judgment, lies somewhere between Stern's base case and Dasgupta's. But if it does, Stern's overall conclusion still stands. Because if you vary the eta to 1.5, increasing the discount rate with a growth rate of 2% to about 3%, you still end up with costs of adverse consequences above and possibly far above the low costs of mitigation. The sensitivities presented in the Stern review showing costs equivalent to between 2.9 and 10.2% of GDP, even if we take a higher eta of 1.5, and even before adjustments for equal weighting of human life rich and poor, and before any allowance for uncertain but potentially important socially contingent effects. Stern's argument for an ethical rather than descriptive basis to the setting of a long-term discount rate is therefore, I believe, compelling. And his conclusion that the costs of climate change greatly outweigh the costs of mitigation is convincing. The economic case for action is therefore clear. But one final argument against early action on climate change has been advanced by Bjorn Lomborg, that emission reductions, whether or not desirable in the long term, are a lower priority than action on other global problems. Lomborg organised the Copenhagen Consensus Project, which asked a panel of respected economists to rank possible policy initiatives on the basis of their benefit to mankind. Three proposed climate change projects were ranked bottom of the list, which instead favoured projects to combat AIDS, malaria, and malnutrition. And Lomborg has paraded the ranking as proof that early action on climate change is uneconomic. But this interpretation of the consensus findings is deeply misleading, given the specific question which was posed, which was, where should the world invest, say, $50 billion over the next 4 years to do most good? Because it's quite possible, in answer to that question, to argue that AIDS and malaria projects should have priority, while also strongly supporting early action to cut carbon emissions. Now, that would obviously be true if we just simply say, well, the world should do all beneficial projects. We could say, well, if climate change mitigation benefits are higher than costs, let's do it, even if the short-term payback to AIDS projects is greater still. We should do both. But it is sometimes useful to accept the discipline of a constrained budget as an intellectual discipline. But even if you do that, the idea of a choice between AIDS projects and climate change responsibility is largely meaningless, because many actions to reduce emissions do not compete for limited resources, but often release them. That is clearly true of many Category 2 actions, energy efficiency improvements. If a company, encouraged by high tax on carbon-intensive electricity, but compensated by a lower payroll tax, identifies energy-efficient projects with a positive net present value, it will be no less able to make charitable donations or corporation tax payments to support the policies which the Copenhagen consensus favours. There is no trade-off there. But this is still more obviously the case in respect to Category 1 actions, changes in consumer behaviour. If individuals feel motivated by climate change responsibility or encouraged by a changed taxation regime to buy a more fuel-efficient car or to go by tube or bike to work, they will have more, not less, resources available for charitable donations to AIDS funds or to pay taxes to support overseas development expenditure. Unless, and this is where the economists might come back at you, unless that is you believe that the existing pattern of consumer expenditures is so perfectly reflective of utterly immutable consumer preferences that any change to a new pattern, even if induced by moral persuasion rather than compulsion, must degrade human welfare. So that, as it were, this now unhappy bicyclist will take compensating action, spending more than the money saved on other forms of shopping therapy. But in many cases, this presumption of an immutable link between existing consumption patterns and welfare or utility or happiness, whatever we call it, clearly does not pertain. In an already materially rich society, many of our consumption patterns are not inherently essential to our welfare or happiness, but reflect deliberately stimulated desires and arbitrary habits, both of which can change without any loss of welfare, utility, or happiness, or whatever you mean. It may be the case that stimulated by a car advertisement, probably shot at about 4 a.m. in northern Sweden, the SUV owner gains psychic benefits from navigating at a snail's pace down the King's Road, because in his imagination, he could have been splashing through a mountain stream. But it is equally possible that stimulated by a desire for climate change responsibility, equivalent psychic benefits can be gained from driving a Prius or a G-Wiz, while driving an SUV can suddenly create happiness-degrading sense of guilt. Meanwhile, by arbitrary habit, Texans set their air conditioning so low that visitors huddle in sweaters and jackets. Set it higher, wear shirts only, and no welfare loss results to the Texan, and for visitors, a significant welfare gain. Not all consumer behaviour changes can be costless in human welfare terms. We shouldn't take that argument that far. There are some which will be more difficult and do have costs. And not all, nor is it true of all Category 2 or Category 3 actions. But there are enough to make the Copenhagen consensus meaningless when applied to climate change actions. As one of the economists involved in that project, Douglas North, pointed out in the project and before the results were published, the climate change projects should have been marked as not applicable in the context of the question posed rather than as low priority. Ladies and gentlemen, there are many aspects of climate change economics I've not addressed tonight. I've not considered the choice between different policy instruments. Should we use carbon trading systems or taxation or direct regulation? The answer is a mix of all three, with different instruments more effective in different sectors and markets. And I've not talked about one very strong argument for early action and for a clear framework for future emission reductions, the fact that the expectation of steadily tightening policy will foster technological developments which reduce the costs of mitigation so that the mitigation cost in economic parlance is endogenous to the model rather than an external given. But I have considered whether some economists are right in saying that sound economics tells us to delay action or to focus on other priorities. It does not. And I have sought to suggest the role which the discipline of economics should play in deciding climate change policy as a tool to help us think about preferences and ethics, but not as a substitute for judgment and choice. The more we care about future generations or more vulnerable people than ourselves, the more we will choose early action. The more we value environmental balance as an end in itself, the more we will be willing to change behaviour and to support taxation policies which encourage us to change it. And the more we recognise that some of our consumer behaviours are not immutably necessary to our happiness, but the product of manufactured desires and simple habits, the easier we will find it to change behaviour. Economics is a discipline which helps us think more clearly about choices. It is not a black box which tells us what our choices should be. Thank you very much.
That concludes a speech by Lord Adair Turner on the economics of climate change, given February 7, 2007 at Savoy Place in London. You can find the whole speech at www.ecoshock.org in the Climate Download section.